G'day, folks. Talk to Dr. Scott Avery and Roland Afile on all things intersectionality to do with disability and Aboriginality. And with Dr. Scott Avery, proud Warramai man, he's an Indigenous disability researcher and currently a lecturer at the Western Sydney University. Roland Afile is the director of DSC and has 3 decades of experience in the disability sector, now working with a team of NDIS expert consultants, with half of them with lived experience. So, DSC, I'm a part of this marvellous team also, and they specialise in NDIS strategy, business models, training, and have a whole e-learning library ready for you to subscribe to or to buy individual modules. And at the checkout, type in "keep rolling" and you'll get a 10% discount. So get some knowledge into ya. And also I want to thank our other sponsor, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these 4 wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs. Oh yeah.
So gentlemen, thanks for jumping on board here through the wide web and having yarn about intersectionality and First Nations, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Disability Australia, hey?
Pleasure to be here, brother.
Yep. And
thanks for inviting me, Jake.
Thanks, guys. So I just want you to introduce yourself. So we've got online here, we've got Dr. Scott Avery and we've got Roland Afile. So brother Scott, if you don't mind kicking it off, Dr. Avery, and just tell us who you are and where your mob's from.
Yeah, so I'm an Aboriginal man from Warramai. That's my Aboriginal nation. So I always say, if you're driving from Sydney to Brisbane and you cross the Karoo River, and before you get to the Manning River, like, we're river people, I always think that's how you know where you are in New South Wales. So that's where my nation's from. Never actually lived on country. I'm down on Dharawal country, down in the southern suburbs of Sydney. So that's where I am. And I'm currently a senior lecturer at the School of Social Sciences at Western Sydney University. So I started there this year, but have a long affiliation with the First Peoples Disability Network, who are an Aboriginal disability organisation. And I still retain an affiliation there as a research partner. And probably the only other interesting thing that you want about me, other than being a Parramatta supporter, is that I'm also profoundly deaf. And very proud of all of the above.
That's great, fella. And Mr. Roland Afile, mate, mate, was really important to bring you on here too, because just the background that you've got, the extensive background in Disability Australia, and with you leading the charge with DSC, and because, you know, you got myself and Scott, two proud Aboriginal men, and it was really important to bring yourself on to have that perspective, that non-Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander perspective, to weigh in on, you know, the important discussions that we're going to be having here today, mate. So, you know, glad to have you on. And just if you can give a background on, you know, yourself and where you're from and DSC.
Sure. And thanks for inviting me, Jake. And I think I've asked you 3 times whether I really should be on this podcast or not as a non-Indigenous person. So really appreciate the invitation, and I hope I have something to contribute. Scott, you don't know me, but 30 plus years in the disability sector, working on deinstitutionalisation in the late 1980s through to being a director of DSC now. We're an organisation with 69,000 subscribers. It's we just seem to be going from strength to strength during COVID. Really, really deep subject matter expertise in the NDIS, and that's what our people love doing. Me, I've got a very eclectic background in disability, and when I do contribute, I hope it comes from that background. But basically service provision, very, very extensively what is sometimes seen as being the evil empire or service providers, that's the background I come from, but also a lot of peak advocacy work. I've done a lot of policy peak advocacy work and a little bit of academic stuff along the way, Dr. Scott. So thanks for the invitation.
Beauty. So Dr. Avery, Scott, brother, I've known you for a while, and like for a fair while now, and you've done some, in the time that I've known you, you've done some real intense, important work throughout the nation and where that's made impact, not just in Australia, but overseas. And being a leader, First Nations disability researcher and advocate across the nation, where did your journey start?
It's really fascinating. I get asked that, and it's really hard to put a start point on it, because I think where I grew up, I grew up in Wollongong, and bit of a hard scrabble kind of experience there, you know. So I've always been known as the deaf guy. Like, that came about probably my mid-teens. It was just like, oh, you know, got picked up. And it's funny how that just kind of became part of my identity. But that part, like, Australia's really not real good at multitasking when it comes to intersectionality. You get to be one thing. So I become a bit of the deaf guy and didn't talk too much about the Aboriginal side of things. And it probably wasn't until I started getting right into the research, and I didn't know much about it myself. I knew, you know, I had the Aboriginal heritage and that, and we didn't talk about it too much. Wasn't encouraged, but at the same time, it wasn't, you know, I can't talk about it hard way. And I just started finding out more and more about this, about my Aboriginal heritage, and just was happening, you know, with Aboriginal people. And I kind of went, oh, that can't be right in this country. It just kind of has stuck there. And it's one of those things that you take a little step and you open your eyes up, and it enlightens you, and you go, oh, I want to go further and not further. And it got to a point where I kind of had, I suppose now people would call it like the nervous breakdown, I guess. You know, I had a period in my life where it just my sort of, I always describe it, my moral compass got crashed, you know, and come out of that. And I thought, well, what is it I wanted to do? And I thought, no, I wanted to make this central to what I was doing with my life. I was very disillusioned, you know, working in sort of corporate kind of roles. And so I ended up in this space, and I have a health background, as in health policy background. So from that, I started working in Aboriginal health. And then I started asking, well, where's Aboriginal disability? And when I started doing this work, you know, 2010-ish, in a very focused way, there wasn't much I could work with. And I kind of was connected loosely with the Aboriginal disability community. I knew them. I was working in an Aboriginal community controlled organisation, more in a health capacity. I'm going, what I'm reading in policy and what I'm reading in the research does not reflect what people are telling me on the phone working in an Aboriginal community organisation. And very influential scholar, mentor, I guess, Professor Lisa Jackson-Pulver, very renowned academic, kind of was at the time going, oh, I think you need to do something about that. I think you need to do a PhD. And funnily, you know, that around that time, Joe Hockey was cutting everyone's budgets in the Aboriginal sector. And 2 days before Christmas, there was a line written through my job saying, you may not have a job after Christmas. And that's when I went, you know what, I'm just going to go in. I'm just going to do it. And develop a plan to do Aboriginal disability. Didn't know what it was. I just sort of started with, tell me your story, and just hear people's stories. So people like your story, Jake, and just said, tell me your story and we'll make it out of it. Because I just felt there was this untold story there. No one knew it. and people in policy and research were kind of guessing without any context at all. So that's what it became. I just thought, well, I'm just going to go around and collect people's stories. And the more I got to meet people and hear their stories and listen to them, I thought, wow, there's such this wisdom in Aboriginal people with disability. So that's become what drew me in. It's really hard to actually have a point. It has really been, like I said, it's almost like I get pulled into it and found a calling more than a job.
Yeah, and being in that calling, mate, being in community-based research, so just what's the power of collating voices from the mob and the story of disability and what that can put out in the atmosphere?
I think it's a shift you have. People talk about empowerment and disempowerment, and I thought one thing that everyone owns that no one else can replicate is their own story and their experience. And I think that's something that's been very empowering for people. No one can replicate what you have gone through or capture that wisdom. And I think people have, in sharing their story, it's almost part of their own personal healing process. People have experienced quite extreme social isolation. And it was quite confronting to me hearing some of these stories as well, going, and it happened to like a confined group of people. But there was this kind of, and I don't use the word resilience carefully here, but it's almost like this endurance about survival. And so there's this great survival story sitting there. And I'm just going, wow, what I could do, and recognizing my own privilege that I'm hearing these stories and people were generous enough to share that, you know, quite intimate story. Then what it was for what we were trying to do is reflect that story back to them. And I think the empowering thing was people were trying to survive on their own, might be trying to survive on their own, but the power becomes in belonging to something bigger. Mm. And that's where I think this notion of community. And so as soon as we took it away from the individual story, you know, they shared their story and saying, this is actually part of a community story here. This is a community narrative of Aboriginal people with disability. Those people felt like they belonged to something, and they kind of could make sense of what was happening in their life. And they kind of went, I thought it was just me, but there's people who have a shared experience that I have. It mightn't be exactly what happened to me, but there's that shared experience. But we also have this sort of value of caring, sharing, respect as well. And that idea of a community is what brings people who might be personally isolated into something bigger. And what we see is people keep going with that, and they go, you know what, my story helps others, so I'm going to share it. And I think that's what I'm seeing, this trajectory happening.
So Jake's asking you about power, Scott, and so much of your work is about power, isn't it? And I know you talk about disrupting power structures, and the person I work with, Vanessa Toy, often talks about all leadership is about disrupting power and power bases. Do you want to talk a little bit about your thinking around disrupting power structures and just how difficult that's proven to be? And is that one of the major obstacles to getting real reform?
I think one of the work is there's institutionalized power structures, which are very hierarchical in that, like, I control the funding, I control the money, I have the right of veto, you know, that kind of institutionalized power structure. And people who run systems kind of, you know, they're saying, that has a culture and a value of itself. I suppose the way I think about power is, any academics who are here, they are influenced by the philosophies of Paulo Freire. And he talks about emancipatory power and how people who are oppressed are great teachers. That's the underpinning. And that got me thinking about, what does power really mean? And I came across something, it kind of was, you know, a crying baby has power when you think of that. So it's understanding what power is in many people and thinking about power differently. And so what we're talking about now is the power of a narrative, the power of a story to tell and expose an issue. And we can do it not just saying, look, this is what's happening in our lives, but doing it in a way that can people can relate to and can connect with. And I think that's where the power is starting to shift, is saying there is a power in people who live this. It's a wisdom and a knowledge that cannot be replicated by reading a textbook. And that is very powerful. And no one can replicate that kind of knowledge. And I think when people see that, they go, wow, actually, I actually have something that no one can take away from me. It's my life, my experience. And when people see that and embrace that and come together, when they start collecting as a community, that's when we're starting to see kind of movements and social change happening. And so I think my work is really about resetting some of the values upon which traditional institutionalized systems are structured upon, and almost testing their philosophy. Why do they exist? What is your purpose?
And where the narrative starts, Scott, when we're talking about intersectionality, can you explain what is intersectionality and how that's woven into the fabric of First Nations Disability Australia?
So again, intersectionality is really about power, and it's about almost layers of empowerment or disempowerment. So where is someone who has multiple oppressions, that's the language that the academics like to use, where do they sit in the social hierarchy? It's a bit antithetical to in traditional Indigenous cultures, this idea of a social hierarchy that kind of othered people with disability. The anthropological evidence in Aboriginal community says that wasn't completely absent, but that was not a value. Aboriginal communities were more inclusive of people with disability, just the nature of their society. So it's different here. So when colonization came in, it imported this power structure. And, you know, so you got sort of, if you're a white professional male, what power do you have? But if you're, say, an Aboriginal woman living in a remote community who might have cancer and caring for someone, you know, there's layers of disempowerment that you are in. So what intersectionality said is saying that you can't just address one aspect of that marginalization. So something like close the gap, a contemporary argument about close the gap, doesn't include disability. So it kind of treats Aboriginal people so saying, look, we won't worry about disability, we'll get there. So it sets up its systems, its policy around the whole of population. But if you're a person with disability, you have barriers to accessing systems and services. You don't just cop racism, you cop ableism as well. And unless that's factored in as a barrier to accessing services, they won't actually meet the goals. A really good example is in the education system, if you don't mind me going there.
Jump in, mate.
Yeah, we've got data that says one in three Aboriginal people with disability incur a long-term suspension from school. So that's kind of going, well, that's that sector. You're going, so they're not even in the classroom. So how are they going to meet their educational attainment if they're not even in the classroom? And it just seems to be quite just blow. Once you add Aboriginal and disability together, that intersection, the inequality you face just kind of goes through the roof. And that carries all the way through, whether you're looking at health, whether you're looking at the education system, whether you're looking at employment outcomes, inequality is greater if you bring those two attributes together. And the logic flows if you add women to that as well.
Yeah, and this is what you've coined, which is what I love, Scott, and that you've led the charge with, is where it starts with the bad black kid syndrome. Yeah?
And that's right. It's challenging it. So the way we tend to see disability, we talk about models of disability. So there's a medical model. And if I can be pretty course about this. It's kind of like medical model. It sees a person with disability, goes, oh, we can fix you. It's that kind of, it starts, it's the dis part that they want to get rid of, you know, like, and that's how it's framed. So I'm going to fix you personally. A social model goes, well, it's not you that's broken, the person, it's the environment that's broken. So we will accommodate you. Now, these are important dimensions, but what we want to introduce is this idea of cultural inclusion. It's an inclusion model. So it sort of says, look, you know, you just need to belong to something. And that's what we want to include you with. So you take that analogy again of, say, a deaf child going to school, the medical model will say, well, we'll give you a cochlear implant or hearing aids. That's a medical model. The social model goes, oh, well, we'll look at the classroom structure and maybe put, you know, hearing loops around so everyone's fine. Now, that'll fix that. But what do you do about the kid who gets picked on and bullied and won't engage because he's got a hearing problem or think they've got isolated? So they won't engage in that. They may not even say they have a hearing problem. They might not reach out because they're worried that they will not be included. And that's what this complementary idea of let's get a discussion happening around inclusion. How do we factor inclusion into our education curriculum to address this idea of if I've got a disability, the stigma attached to that, how can I alter that? And I think this is where narrative is going to lead the way.
Yeah, because that's a major. You go, Roland, jump in.
I want to ask you, Jake, because the bad black kid syndrome, which Scott talks about, you work at the pointy end of that a lot in the New South Wales justice system with kids. And I was just going to ask you what your opinions on it are.
Yeah, it's along the same lines with Scott here. So from what I've seen over the years, and that's with working in and around the justice scene through New South Wales, but also seeing it on a national scale, and it's going back to the stories, going back to the narratives of where it starts, because I know personally of, say, one story where this kid, he was 11 years of age, where he started going into the system and where it didn't get picked up that he had a hearing impairment, a disability, until he was 17 going 18, going from juvenile justice to going into the adult population system in prison. And these stories, that's one of many. And this is happening time and time again. And that's where it all starts with what Scott has coined with the bad black kid syndrome, where you've got this kid that's in the class and it's not recognized of what's going on with if they have a disability or not. And no one reaches out. No one really discusses what's going on with that kid. So they put them in the back of the class and where that exacerbates the problem and where then they got a whole life trajectory of where that may lead into just failing within the education system. And then those frustrations end up leading out to the open environment and where it leads to getting in trouble as a juvenile, going into juvenile justice systems, and if they don't have the appropriate help throughout their child and teenage years, then they end up being just another number in the systemic cycle of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia, of the numbers within the adult population system in jail, where, you know, we're overrepresented. Where the overrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia is out of control. And it's just frustrating just seeing that system. Just, it's the same story across the nation, and we really have to jump in and make a difference of where it all starts in the classroom.
And Roland, I see it as a trajectory. It's like at every point in a child's life, they could be supported. But at that moment when they could be supported, it's like this punitive model comes in, whether it's the education system or, you know, like they either get punished or excluded. So they get suspended from school rather than going through. So it ends up to the point where they end up in the justice system. And the justice system would look at the facts of the incident. They don't take into account the backstory that people have got there, a very multifaceted trauma. And if you have a look at some statistics, we got some statistics out of the New South Wales juvenile justice system, and this classic story of intersectionality, where you have, so it's Aboriginal young people are 24 times more likely to be in juvenile detention compared to the general population. Yeah. But if you add, and I've just had one dimension, which was intellectual disability. So if you are Aboriginal and intellectual disability, that 24 times goes to in excess of 200 times.
That's insane. It's just insane.
It's just, and it's actually quite paralyzing to hear that because the profile you have. But it's not only that, these people have, you know, they have intellectual disability, they have hearing, a lot of them had head injuries, so they've been knocked out. And if you're a young woman in jail, that's twice as likely to men, so you get intersectionality here. And you just kind of go, there's something that's just screaming out a systemic failure. But how we deal with these in the system is almost to problematize the individual. And I said, we got to stop thinking about that vulnerability is inherent in the young person, young Aboriginal person. They're made that way. They're made vulnerable. This vulnerability is, they're maneuvered into that because this kind of sort of tacit, all the way this tacit kind of institutionalized racism and ableism coming together has basically foreclosed any growth and potential opportunities they have and sent it down that path. And as depressing as that sound, if we see it as a trajectory and seeing it as a stage of the development, we can then go, this is the hard work we have to do. How do we alter that? Where are the pivot points in that trajectory where we can flip it from ending up in juvenile detention and flip it into something like a supported disability program?
Yeah, and that's what's frustrating for me, just like what you're talking about, Scott, just with the racism and where you have a lot of the subconscious bias, like before the teacher even walks into the room, and where there's already notions running around in their head when they're dealing with some of the youngsters here, and when they're not getting that attention, and when they've got the, you know, the intellectual cognitive disabilities, or what I was going back to with the story before that I was talking about with the hearing impairment. So that was with that child that was about to go into the adult population system because they didn't pick up that he had a hearing impairment from the age of 11, and he couldn't even spell his first. He could only spell his first and last name. And that's just where we need to, as a nation, of really trying to address this issue and show these numbers and really and push this trajectory through, which is what I want to jump into next and want to know your thoughts and feelings about the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, a major national social reform. And I want to know, just from both of your perspectives, what you think of the NDIS and the positives of it, the negatives, and how it affects Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Disability Australia.
I want to be cheeky, Scott, and ask you, respond by asking you the question, putting the spotlight on you. But looking at your work, Scott, you talk about structural versus personal agency, and this is where I'm pretty sure Jake is leading us. The NDIS is very much built around an individual's funding and supporting an individual. Mm. And what you're both talking about is significant structural and systemic issues that are not addressed. The ILC has not been at all successful. That's meant to be the systemic bit of the NDIS. Has not been successful at all, I would say, in that space. You want to jump in, Jake?
Yeah, did you said the ILC, yeah?
Yep.
Yeah, and do you want to explain just to the listeners and viewers, Roland, what ILC is?
Okay, so when they set up the NDIS, they set it up as an individualised scheme, and they acknowledged that really the sort of things that Scott has been talking about, unless we change society to be more inclusive, we're going to be pissing a lot of money up against the wall. And so if we, so they set up a minor scheme. The percentage of the actual spend of the $22 billion is so small. And they set it up in the ILC program to fund societal change. It's fair to say it hasn't been very successful. And it's fair to say the NDIS is still, you know, 98% focused on supporting individuals. What we do know, and we do know before the NDIS began, was that it wouldn't work for Aboriginal communities. It's a collective culture. Individualised support does not work. And we've known that, and we haven't done very much about it. So I wanted to hand on the difficult question to Scott about, you know, personal agency and the NDIS is all terrific, but not when the problems are essentially systemic.
Yeah, and I think if you have a look at the design principle, again, this is like they've had a, we just go the AMARC approach and that's it. So one approach for the entire population of people with disability. Yep. And the thing about market approach and all this, what it does, and it's designed to do, it gravitates towards this midpoint of efficiency, will efficiently allocate resources. Yep. And it's based on this point where going, well, it's efficient where like supply equals demand, basically. So the provision of disability services and will empower people with disability and they can choose whichever they want. So personal empowerment because with choice and I'll purchase services. Now, the fundamental assumption of that is that there is a market to buy from. And the thing is, particularly when you get out into very remote areas, there's not the provision of services. Now, if it's just left to the market alone, market will be great when you want to provide access. So you put out a website and you go, look, I'm going to build a website. I'm going to have a forum and people can come and people can sign up to the scheme. But, and that'll be great. That'll work up to that equilibrium midpoint. The question is, what happens to those group of people who have access barriers that are beyond that midpoint, if you like? And it's people who have culturally different backgrounds, who might speak about different disability in a way that's not the language that it's really efficient to talk about disability in a particular way. Mm. So Aboriginal people talk about disability in a different way. And I imagine there would be other ethnic groups who talk about disability in a different way. Now, if you've got to spend a bit more time, effort, energy and resources to reach those people. And the thing is, if you've just got a market doing that, it's not going to get there. So you've got to kind of push the market. You can't just rely exclusively on a market. Similarly with remote, and I'll give a really good example we picked up when we're traveling remote Northern Territory. And they were saying people were coming in and offering, they were committing expenditure. So they weren't, this is not actual money here. They were committing expenditure to say, you can provide up to a certain amount of money to purchase services. You know, to say you might have an automated wheelchair in there. I don't know what, you know, the kind of things that you're looking at. Or you might have, you know, you can access a speech pathologist. And the so it's a personal agency approach there and people can choose to buy. But if there's no one there and it's not economical for disability service providers to be there, they can't spend the money, they can't buy that. Same group of people are saying, actually, you know what we need? We need food and blankets because we're starving and we're homeless and, you know, so we need blankets because we live out in the area. Really fundamental, basic human rights, health infrastructure that they do not have, fundamentals on which a market get built. That's not there. But the NDIS are going, oh, that's not our remit. Yeah, that's somebody else's remit. So we're lacking this interface between personal agency and structure. And that's a fundamental problem. We've got to push that. And there'll be certain groups. And it's not just access, you know, the kind of physical access. Mm. You've also got to see, you know, people have had really bad experiences. Aboriginal people have had their, you know, families and children, the children taking away.
That legacy. Intergenerational trauma.
Yeah.
And that sits there. That sit there. And this kind of, so this trust that people will come forward, particularly when disability is involved, it's like this dark cloud sitting there. And so it should not be presumed that people are going to come out and reach that just because, you know, the builder, and they will come philosophy. So I think that's that. And I think how it's operating, if I can jump to that now, is that...
Can I jump in, Scott? Because I really want to ask a question that's about the NDIA's policy on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. And one of the fundamental tenets of it, and I'd be very interested in your response to it, is that they will go in when invited. And that's the one of the fundamental policies. And what you're saying is that that's flawed. Waiting for Aboriginal communities to invite the National Disability Insurance Agency in is almost like an excuse for inaction, isn't it?
And again, the invitation to problematise Aboriginal communities, go, well, you didn't invite us in, it's your problem.
Yep.
And I just kind of go, we really need to push through that. And that's some of the concern that I have about how it's operating. And when I see the numbers that they're saying that they're getting enrolled in their quarterly reports, and one thing that I've alert to is that they report on committed expenditure, not actual expenditure. So I kind of think there's not enough interrogation on what they're actually doing, because I see their numbers and they just don't seem plausible to me. And the kind of example I've heard before, or they're signing people up to say a $60,000 plan, first instance, so they're reporting the $60,000, but they can't spend that because the services aren't there. So six time around it's $5,000 maybe. And I just concerned that where it's always tricky, because I think the philosophy of the NDIS, people want it to work. By the same token, we want it to work in a way that it was designed to. And I am concerned that some of these institutional factors are really taking hold and creeping in. And it's just going to be so harder to dislodge them. And it's going to be the people who need the NDIS most are going to be the ones that are missing out.
So with these most vulnerable Australians, Scotto, when we're talking, going back to what Roland was talking about with the ILC, with the information linkages, capacity building. So where you've got the NDIS that throughout the year, they put X amount of buckets of money through different programs. So ideally, if we weren't going to worry about the limit of money, and especially when we're looking at rural and remote Australia, and if we had the dollars to go behind what we could do within community, how would you weigh in on the fact if there could be something designed to help the mob?
Look, and I'm very cautious that I say I don't come with solutions. I come with a process to get to the solutions. And I think it starts with taking a step back, because I said, it's almost like we need to challenge some of the assumptions, dislodge some of the assumptions upon which this whole, whether it's the scheme, is built. And the other side of it, which is more around the structural agency, is closing the gap. And I think those two things need to come together. At the moment, we're kind of, I kind of think where disability is the last one through the door and the first one shown it, you know what I mean? Because it ends up in the too hard basket. We've got to invert that and going, okay, whether it's the education system, whether it's the NDIS, can we start and work our way backwards from pick some example? What does it mean to an Aboriginal man living in a town camp? What does it mean there, and work our way back? And I think if we can start from people who we can imagine having, and these are people we know are in our community, these examples go, what does it mean to a mother of two children who's really concerned that they'll be taken away from her? And these threats are real. How can we break down and understand some of the access barriers, and then work our way back and going, well, what does it mean to the systems and services that are being designed that way? And I think it's about infusing this, what I call this tacit community knowledge in the design. So I'm probably advocating more of a process to inject this community knowledge and wisdom, complementing how systems, you know, service system deliveries. I've never actually run a system or worked in a system. So, there'll be people with that expertise, but I think we have to have the capacity to bring these considerations together. And I've done a lot of work in the disability around the National Disability Strategy, and I don't see close the gap people in that room. And I get to close the gap, and I do not see disability people in that room. We're pretty much, you know, I was working at First Peoples Disability. We're the only ones that were trying to do it. And we just didn't have enough critical mass to go, we need to change how we think about this and invert it. It's almost like we've lost the purpose of starting with people who are most in need and working backwards. We're kind of going, how can we get the low-hanging fruit, the quick wins? Let's get a scheme up. Let's enroll as many people as we can. But the systems and services and the culture that gets entrenched into that, you know, and the data, the statistics, the narratives all show it's the people most in need are the ones most likely to miss out.
And talking about the statistics there, Scott, with just talk us through your relationship with ABS, with the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and how that's helped put out the narrative of the work that you've put in.
Yeah, so we did some great work, and you know, in a few weeks' time, you'll have to come back, because I'm doing some really good work around hearing impairment, and it's a similar story that we've heard right across the disability. And it's, if you're an Aboriginal person and disability, the inequality that you experience in terms of social outcome measures that can be measured, quantified, a number put on it, is twice that of other groups, whether Aboriginal without disability or people with disability who aren't Aboriginal. So we kind of got statistical proof that intersectional inequality exists. Now, that's, when you talk to individuals and they tell their story, it's very personalised. You feel that human element. What accessing the data does, and this is understanding that statistics and data is a language of government. We're saying it's not just this one-off that's happening here. It's this group of people. It applies to this entire group of people. So the individual who sees that going, oh, well, my existence is validated. It's legitimised now. Because it's not just me. I thought it was just me. I thought I was personally problematized. I was the bad black kid. But we elevate it going, no, this is structural because it's happening. The pattern of data, whether we look at education, justice, employment, I think when we look at the NDIS and get some scrutiny around that number, I think it'll reveal this pattern as well. So there's something, it's identified, it lifts it from the individual to focusing it on structural institutionalized racism and how they intersect. So it's really putting it back onto the system. That's where the system reform will come from. And the significance of the data is, I said, well, that's not my data, it's the Australian Bureau of Statistics data I'm using. And that relation we have, so very good relationship with the Australian Bureau of Statistics in enabling me to access this data, because it's not easy to find. You've really got to dig down in it, because we don't, disability data is, you know, not, if I was talking health, you'd be able to find things, but you've really got to, you know, it's like you need to be an investigative journalist in a way. And the ABS relationship has facilitated access to that, which has helped me tell a story. And it's helped me lift it from his stories of 47 Aboriginal people, which gave the human context to it all. I'm going to tell the autobiography of our community. and the statistics has made it that. So that's been the power of that, those two elements coming together.
So, you go ahead, Roland, jump in. Sure? Mate. Yeah, mate.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of academic concepts that you've thrown up, Scott, that I find particularly fascinating. The relationship, but more about between power and other, but more for you to talk about what other is and explain that from your perspective, because I think it's such a powerful concept.
Sorry, what was that one there?
The concept of other, othering.
Othering. So this is actually drawn from disability scholarship, and I came across this term. It's used occasionally, but it got me reflecting how racism and ableism, they're forms of discrimination which can be personal and institutionalized, but they operate differently. So the people that I was speaking with, when they spoke about racism, it was like they were being attacked, you know. So there was a personal attack. Someone would come and insult them, swear at them, you know, like call them a name or something like that. So it was kind of like attacking them. And that was the kind of racism that I got picked up. When people were talking about their experience of disability, it was like, it's like I'm not even in the room. People will avoid me. And people were saying that, you know, if I went to a cafe or something like that, people would talk around me, they wouldn't talk to me. So there was one testimony that I got from an Aboriginal young woman in university, and she said she was doing like the job agency stuff, they never spoke to her, they always spoke to her mother. I'm going, hang on, I'm here, it's about me. It was like they were kind of, they couldn't, and I call it the center point of awkwardness. It's like people were really awkward about it. And these,
yes, you know what that feels like.
Look, as a unit in a university within a couple of years' time, I think that's something that's going to make it be, you know, we teach Aboriginal health. We just got to teach something Aboriginal disability, and we're letting people know. And I think that's the next stage of our community's development, leading it, but. Yeah. It's going to feed into sector development. It's going to lead into workforce, you know. Mm. So that's the pathway. And, you know, I want to hand over to people like you too, Jake.
Mate, well, beautiful. Well said, Scott. And folks, if you're watching, if you're listening, what Dr. Avery put out there, Frontier. Community-based led, get amongst it. We need, you know, high tide raises all canoes. We really need to jump in and, you know, help our brothers and sisters, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders and everybody in between. Doesn't matter if you're black, white or brindle. So we need to get in and have a crack. So I really appreciate you gentlemen coming on board and discussing these important topics. Roland, did you have anything else that you wanted to throw in the atmosphere?
I really, really, really appreciate the chance to have the chat with Scott. Scott, is your book in reprint or you're putting it back out again?
I believe it. So the first reprint was 500 and I believe it's sold out.
Yeah, it has.
Yes. And we're just in discussions for a second reprint. Unfortunately, the COVID, not being in the office, because the First Peoples Disability Network are the publishers of that. And I just think the COVID situation has meant they haven't had a chance to organise a reprint. But hopefully that'll be the version, edition number two, whatever it's called.
Can you tell us the title? Just tell us what the book is?
Yeah, so it's just, it's Cultural Inclusion, a narrative of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with disability. And it's the First Peoples Disability Network. So I pretty much gave it to them. I said, this is a community. And I just think that tells you that, you know, it was published just on 2 years ago. It's still there. It's still ticking away. This is like this constant burn that's happening. This isn't going anywhere. So I just keep an eye out for them. I might contact my Epidin contacts to say, you know, you put an announcement, I'm getting asked. But they're the people to contact.
Thank you very much, Jake, for inviting me.
Awesome. So, Dr. Avery, Scott, if people want to get a hold of your brother, if it's general, if it's emails or social media, if you want to put any of that out in the atmosphere, how can people get a hold of you? Yeah.
So I'm at the Western Sydney University. So if you just go on there and search for my name, probably the easiest is to go on to the Western Sydney University website and just look for me there. It's Scott Avery. I'm with the School of Social Sciences. Probably the easiest way to do is just drop me a line. And if you're interested in getting involved in this work, you know, let us know, because we kind of want to know who is out there. And I just think there's a bit of a shift in recognition. If not now, it's on its way.
Awesome. And Roland, if you want to throw out, you know, the important work that Disability Services Consulting is doing and all the social media that's behind that and the podcast, mate, throw it out in the atmosphere.
Thanks very much, Jake. Yep, our podcast is called Disability Done Different, Candid Conversations. You'll probably find it by doing that. And Jake Briggs, keep on rolling.
All right, gentlemen, much appreciated. Can't wait to get this one out there.
It's a good one.
And then we'll talk soon. It'd be good to take up this conversation again. So, see, great insight from Dr. Scott Avery. Proud Warramai man. In the world of intersectionality, First Nations people and disability. You heard the man. New frontier. So if you want to get into that sector, contact the man. There's plenty of work to be done. Boots on the ground. Get amongst it. And it was great having Roland on. Just having the perspective from someone in the conversation that's non-Indigenous. And his 3 decades of experience in the disability sector. You know, he's got great insight, great thoughts. Leader also. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StreetRollingCheetah or email one word, StreetRollingCheetah@gmail.com. And we're also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. And want to thank our sponsors, DSC, Disability Services Consultants. I'm a part of this marvellous team that specialise in NDIS strategy, training, business models, and have a whole e-learning library ready for you to subscribe to or to buy individual modules. So at the checkout, type in Keep Rolling and you'll get a 10% discount. So get some knowledge into you. I want to thank one of our other sponsors, Permobil Australia, greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they have great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.